There are school districts in Florida taking part in the Guardian program, and that means some teachers may be armed on campus. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Almost a dozen school districts in the state are taking part in the Guardian program. That means they can have teachers who are armed. But the law doesn't mean that we're allowed to know which teachers. We'll find out why. Also, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald have taken a lot of financial hits, as has the newspaper industry. Now many of the employees are working to form a union. We'll get the details. And sea level rise is a reality for politicians to start planning for the future. Architects and designers are already planning. We'll learn about a project in North Miami that might be a community saver. Finally, we take a look at this year's Outshine Film Festival that starts this week. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. In a number of schools across Florida, teachers and trained faculty will be coming to work this week armed. They're part of a new Guardian program. It went into effect last week. Now, the program was an initiative proposed after the Parkland tragedy that allows for certain trained personnel to carry guns on campus. Broward and Miami-Dade are among the 36 counties that have expressed interest in the Guardian program, according to the Department of Education. Ana Ceballos is with the News Service of Florida and has been following the story. She joins us now from Tallahassee. Ana, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's remind ourselves of how the Guardian program is supposed to work.
Sure. So the way the Guardian program works, it's a voluntary program. State lawmakers set aside a pot of money to allow sheriffs to train school staff. Now classroom teachers are also part of that category, where they can go through a program. It's extensive training. They go through background checks, psychological tests as well, and teachers and school personnel can volunteer and be approved by the school district. And then after that training is complete, they can go in classrooms and be authorized to carry weapons in school, just to protect in case of an active shooting situation.
And so if I'm a teacher and I'm interested in taking part, I know my district is taking part, I can just step up and talk to the principal or to the school superintendent and say, I want to be part of this. How does that work?
Right. You would have to volunteer. No one is forced to participate in this program. It's voluntary for teachers or for school staff to participate, but someone who volunteers doesn't necessarily mean that they would be a guardian. They would still have to pass the firearm testing, pass the background checks, and go through this rigorous training that the sheriff's office would do at the local level. And after that is completed, they would be qualified to act as a guardian.
And the other thing too is this, is just thinking about what kind of weapon is a teacher who goes through all of that, passes it, what kind of weapon are they allowed to have with them? And I'd imagine, you know, it's got to be out of reach of the students and nobody could see it, right?
Well, I think that's one of the points of contention during the legislature, during the legislative sessions, when they're discussing these specific questions about, well, where do teachers or where do the principal or the coach, where would they put their guns? They always say that that will be a decision made at the local level. So at the statewide, there's no blanket decision as to where to safely store weapons. It's more of a local decision based on an individual school board's decision and what they want to do and what they want to be. What they want their school personnel who will be armed to do.
Yeah. Do we know how many school districts, which school districts are actively participating in this program?
So that remains to be a lingering question, which I'm assuming will be a pretty big topic of discussion during the upcoming legislative session in January. We know as of 2 weeks ago that there are 11 Florida counties with school districts or 11 Florida school districts with an interest in participating in the Guardian program and allowing classroom teachers to be armed. So in total, statewide, there's 36 school districts who have who are participating in the program, but 11 of them are specifically allowing classroom teachers, to be clear.
And what we know is that Broward and Miami-Dade school districts have expressed interest, right?
Yes, correct. But they have different... The program just will be different for certain school districts, depending on what the local school district has approved.
And in those, in my understanding, in those districts, the teachers will not be armed. They're going to have armed guards.
Correct. But the bigger problem is that when you're looking at this program statewide, there are questions about what exactly will be happening at how they're going to be arming classroom teachers. And the State Department for Education has said that they don't really track, for example, the number of classroom teachers who will be participating. They just track the districts who are participating.
Why is that? Why aren't they tracking what teachers or what staff are going to be armed? They just know which districts are allowing it.
Well, publicly, they have not said that. We still don't know if they actually do know that. I have personally asked the department for that information, and they say that they don't track it, that they will be tracking it through the grant application process. When they will be participating in the program, they have to go through applying for money to train these personnel, and they said that they will be tracking that. But the problem is the public will not know the identities of these guardians, because under statute that is protected.
And of course, you know, the other, I'm sure that this has popped up is, you know, what about parents who say, hold on a second. I have the right to know if my son or my daughter's teacher is armed, right?
Right. And that has also been a point of discussion. And at the end of the legislative session, before the Republican-dominated legislature approved this expansion of the program where classroom teachers would be allowed, there were some questions raised in the Senate about this specific issue. They were saying, well, as a parent, would I be able to ask and know so I can pull my kid out from that specific classroom because I don't feel comfortable? And it was kind of like an interesting dynamic where we saw some interest from Republicans, you know, who were, huh, like, that's a really good question. But at the end of the day, the bill wasn't really amended to include that specific provision. And again, lawmakers were like, well, let's let the local district decide that, whether or not that should happen.
I'm talking with News Service of Florida reporter Ana Ceballos. Last week, the Guardian program started allowing trained teachers and faculty to be armed on some campuses. Depends on the district. And we want to hear from you. How would you feel if you found out your school had faculty participating? Find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial, or email us at sundial@wlrnnews.org. So, Ana, how is the state going to track the success of this program? How will they know it's working?
Well, the way that you know that it would be working would be by the number of school districts that are participating. Right now, as far as the Guardian program itself, it's a cheaper version of meeting the state requirement to have someone armed on campus to protect students at all times. So this is kind of... it's for districts in rural counties, for example, who might not have that much money. This is an appealing option. But it's still pretty controversial just because it could potentially include classroom teachers, which is not like that's the portion of the program that is not quite as popular as we can see when we go into the 11 districts of 67 that have decided to leave that option for teachers.
And part of the, you know, part of all of this too is the mental health aspect. And all schools now have to have mental health in the curriculum. Do we know how the schools have been rolling this out?
Right. So the mental health portion of it was, it's part of an overall bill, not so much the Guardian program. So it's like the overall school safety legislation or bill that was passed by lawmakers after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. That was a component that was found to be key, right? That they said, well, yes, let's protect students with, you know, having more armed personnel to protect them in case of an emergency. But mental health was a requirement for all 67 school districts, and they all have to submit their plans to the Florida Department of Education every year as to what they're going to be doing with that money. Last year, they allocated $65 million. This year, they want the governor and the Florida Department of Education have expressed interest in doing $100 million.
So have you found any teachers, any educators who are taking part in this, who are willing to share the fact that they're the teacher who is willing to be armed?
I personally have not, and I think that is going to be a pretty difficult thing to do because guardians, their identities are confidential under state law, and there is a reason why the state wants to protect these identities because they don't want to put someone in danger of being identified and, I don't know, potentially facing repercussion or just being a safety issue for that specific person. So unless they come forward and decide to let the public know who they are, it's going to be a difficult thing to identify.
Again, we've been talking with Ana Ceballos, reporter with the News Service of Florida. You can learn more about the Guardian program at WLRN.org. Ana, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
No problem. Thanks so much. Have a good one.
Well, still to come, some of the staff and reporters at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald want to form a union. What's the future of South Florida's biggest newspaper? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Last week, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald announced their intent to unionize. One Herald Guild, if recognized by McClatchy, would become the largest joint newsroom in South Florida to unionize. Now, the move comes as a number of newspapers across the country have moved towards unionizing, with commercial operations continuing to cut staff and resources. We're joined now by Mary Ellen Claus. She's the Capital Bureau Chief of the Miami Herald and the Co-Bureau Chief of the Tampa Bay Times Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau. Mary Ellen Claus, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
So when did the folks at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald start talking about the idea of forming a union?
Well, the origin of this began when we had the surprising and unexpected announcement earlier this year that there would be, hundreds of employees in McClatchy offered a buyout. And those people were obviously people like me who were older veteran employees, and in many cases were sort of, you know, we contribute to the fiber of the newsroom, the backbone of the newsroom. And there were many younger employees who were startled, surprised, and discouraged by this development. And so folks started to talk and say, you know, we really need to get organized. And that's what started this.
What can you tell me about those conversations? Because I know not all staffers are on board with the idea. But I mean, how did that go? You know, people, again, started to build up on this idea, and then you had to have enough support to do it.
Well, it wasn't something done in isolation. What people did is they started reporting it out. They did their homework. They started looking up what other unions did. It started interviewing members of various union organizations and trying to get a sense of what it involved. And then they actually did job interviews with trying to decide who to pick to be their representative. Then once that started, then it was a matter of, well, do we really want to go ahead with it? So that involved conversations with everyone in the newsroom. And it was mostly done through one-on-one and actually listening to people. What are the issues you care about? What is going well for you? What would you like to change? And that evolved to become the basis of the things that we have identified as why we're doing this. It's really been organic.
When you announce the union, and it's like a lot of situations like this, it's about better pay, benefits, resources, security. Let's take a look at McClatchy, the company that owns the Miami Herald. On a corporate level, in 2017, the company reports a loss of about $332 million. In 2018, that was approximately a $79 million loss. If the company's reporting these kind of losses, where's it going to find the money to be able to give employees the sort of things that they're looking for?
Well, that's where I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding here. It is not all about the money. It is about how they manage their existing resources and the priorities they're making with them. You know, there's been a little bit of attention paid to the fact that the CEO of McClatchy is Craig Foreman, and you know he's got an increase in his salary.
Makes $2.8 million now a year, and he's got a $35,000 per month stipend for housing and travel.
That's right. And the question for us is, let's have some transparency. Let's understand why they justify that and why that stipend that he gets on a monthly basis is more than some of our reporters are making. You know, why is that acceptable? And that is the kind of answers and pushback that we believe as employees who are devoting and making sacrifices, and we are dedicated to this job, we expect that we are deserving of answers to the decisions they're making.
How many other McClatchy papers have also gone down this path?
Well, there haven't been any in recent history. The Sacramento Bee papers, the Bee papers in California, which are owned by McClatchy and were the very first papers that McClatchy owned, have all been unionized, but there hasn't been any in recent history. So McClatchy has dealt with union papers in the past. It knows what's involved. So this is not a big surprise.
Well, McClatchy representatives obviously did not want to join us for the program today. We did get a statement from Amanda Marquez Gonzalez, president and publisher of the Miami Herald Company. I'm going to read part of it because it is a long statement. We're going to post it in its entirety online. But this is just part of what that statement read. Quote, "While there are certainly difficult macro trends that are affecting all local news organizations, we are committed to partnering with our employees directly and working through them. We don't believe that introducing a third-party intermediary helps our relationships, generates efficiency, or allows us to adapt and innovate in response to these trends and market conditions. We also don't think our employees need to pay significant dues to a third party, the union, to help address concerns that we can resolve directly with them. Finally, contrary to what the union is claiming, if elected, the union will negotiate with the Miami Herald Company, not McClatchy, our parent company." Again, the entire statement, because it is a long one, is online. What have been these conversations with McClatchy or with, you know, again, the head of Miami Herald Media Company about this unionization effort?
We haven't really had much of a conversation. We asked to be voluntarily recognized, and we gave Mindy and our CEO and the others at McClatchy a week to have conversations with us and talk about why we think they should recognize us right away. The idea behind that was that it would eliminate the need for expense both on their part to hire lawyers to negotiate and to fight our union effort, and that would save money. But they chose not to do that. We gave them a week because we thought it would be an opportunity to have that collaborative conversation that our editor has referred to often, but it didn't happen. So we are going to go ahead and within the next month, we will have a vote. And that will be something that will be overseen by the National Labor Relations Board. They negotiate the constructs of that election, and we will know by the end of the week the date of it and what the terms of the election will be. But I want to respond to the comment.
Go ahead.
Because one of the things we've seen is that all the arguments that Mindy has brought up and others against the union is really pretty much boilerplate. It comes from every anti-union effort in the newspaper business and in other industries as well. There isn't any real original thought here, and nothing that's really applied to the Miami Herald. This idea that we're introducing a third party into these negotiations, that's not it at all, because the union is us. So we are the union. We're just hiring an outside entity to be our consultants, to be our advisors, paying union dues. That argument is pretty old as well. But we have decided that we need some extra help because the opportunity to interact that we've had with McClatchy so far has not been working in our favor.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Kloss. Employees with the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald have announced their intent to unionize. The publisher, McClatchy, has until this week to formally recognize the union. And we should note, WLRN is news partners with the Miami Herald. And you could read more reporting about this unionization effort at WLRN.org. Help me understand, too, the union is aligning itself. It's with the News Guild CWA. That's Communications Workers of America. That's correct?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. How can you point to, you know, tangible benefits that the union has been able to, that they've been able to obtain for its members?
Well, they've been able to negotiate a contract, and that, and the contract then is a set of rules, and that will govern our relationship between how we work with our bosses in the future. We have a relationship right now. It's just that we feel as if other priorities have come ahead of our needs as employees. And some of those priorities obviously have been when they decide they have to cut the budget and they have to blindside us with layoffs or hit us with another round of furloughs. They're imposing, you know, unexpected new rules on how we do our work and the kind of work and the kind of copy they want us to produce. So we're inviting some degree of structure, which that is a necessary component of having a union. And we think that that's not a bad idea. It's a really democratic way to handle it. We're going to vote on it, every contract and every piece of every contract. And then we sit down at the bargaining table and negotiate it with our bosses. And we think that's a really fair way to do it.
You know, we've seen over the last couple of years, you know, writers and reporters unionizing. We've seen newspapers, online forums as well. Like we've seen the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the New Yorker, New York Magazine, the New Republic, Salon, Vice Media, HuffPo, and even in public radio, we just saw WHYY in Philadelphia also move in that direction. What do you see as the reason, you know, that the idea for unions now is growing in the news business?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is, it has to do with the fact that the news business is under more threat than it's ever been. I mean, even for robust news organizations and organizations that are growing, because of social media, the absence of or the dismantling of the traditional revenue source, which has been advertising, because of the other platforms that are a much more efficient way to advertise, those things have led to a decrease in the same kind of job security. And we've found that it's been, you know, we've, for the last decade since the recession, we have so relied on this dismantling of the norms of what we used to do that we've kind of, that our bosses have kind of gotten used to hiring people on a piecemeal basis, hiring freelancers to do things that used to be full-time employees. And I think people are just kind of stopping and saying, we need to hit the reset button. Rethink, is this really good for the kind of journalism we're doing? And let's get organized and maybe push back.
And one other thing, too, is coming back to something you said earlier is, I mean, look, not everybody's on board. And so I'm wondering, you know, if there's a concern that, you know, part of the newsroom might feel a little bit kind of pushed out because they're not, they don't want to go in this direction.
Absolutely not. And that is the one thing we are so determined at the Miami Herald to not let happen, because we get it that some people just don't feel comfortable and that they may have had a bad experience at a union somewhere else, just don't want to do this. But we are still going to be, they're still on our team. And we are still going to be arguing for their rights. In fact, we've watched another news organ, like at the LA Times, at the Miami Herald, the editors cannot organize because they're considered management. But if there were something to happen and they were treated unfairly, you can be sure that this union would come and get, have their back. We watched that happen at the LA Times. There was a very popular editor that was unceremoniously fired, and the union walked out and protested, and the editor got her job back. So we understand that people are not comfortable, but that doesn't mean we aren't trying to lift everybody up at once.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Kloss. Again, you can learn more of the story about unionizing at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald at WLRN.org. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Luis. Take care.
Well, still to come, turning an old lot into a resilient park. We're going to learn about a project that could protect the neighborhood from future flooding. That's up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. As the region continues to change due to climate change, architects and developers are being forced to adapt. Now, there's an effort to build more resilience and for future communities that will be living with more water. Now, the design competition Keeping Current invited architects and designers from all over the world to propose ideas to fix flooding in North Miami. The competition's winner was the Department Design Office team. They were awarded $80,000 to think big and transform one flood-prone park in North Miami into a community space and a stormwater management site. Isaac Stein is the co-founder of the Department Design Office, and he joins us now from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Isaac, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, congratulations, first of all. Your team is the winning proposal. It's called Good Neighbor. And I've seen the renderings. This is really interesting. But I'm walking up to this space. Describe it for us. What is it going to look like?
So the space is a half-acre lot in the middle of a residential neighborhood on the northern edge of the city of North Miami. And it's in the middle of 144th Street between 8th and 10th Avenue. It's 150 feet square on all sides. And essentially, we're turning this park into a stormwater infrastructure retention pond and a public park. So half the park will be designated to retaining water to mitigate flooding for the adjacent neighbors, and half the park will be dedicated to a demonstration garden that sort of highlights the natural ecology of the historic ecology in that neighborhood, and as a way for neighbors to stroll the park, register the fluctuations in the water level of the pond itself, and to get closer to the historic ecology of their neighborhood.
So my understanding, this used to be, there was a house on this property. It was somebody's property, and it always flooded. It was just one of those areas that tends to flood a lot because of the groundwater. And so the government came in and bought it out because it's like, well, you know, you can't live there anymore. And they were happy to leave because of the problems. Is this something that we're going to see a lot more of going into the future? Is that we're going to just have to say to some people, you're going to have to move out because we can use this land for something better, which is to protect the rest of the community?
It's an interesting question, and I guess specifically this lot was a home around 2005 was the last time there was a standing home on it. And it is kind of a condition that does seem likely to come forward, but again, it's not, the way it works is it's a federal-funded buyout program and funded in part by FEMA, where half the funds to buy out the property are funded by Homeland Security and have come from local matching. So it also has to be from the onus of the homeowner to want to achieve the buyout and want to go forward with the paperwork. So essentially, if a homeowner who has national flood insurance makes two separate flood insurance claims within one decade, then there is an opportunity if the city can match funds to buy this resident out and then to basically decommission the parcel.
Now, the other thing, too, is this, looking at the renderings, again, this is going to help in managing flooding for the community. Tell me a little bit about, like, when those floodwaters come in, like, how this park is going to, how it's going to operate in doing that.
Yeah, it works in both a sort of tangible way and a bureaucratic economical structure as well. So the site itself is around 20,000 square feet. And it's, as you mentioned, a local low point. So it's kind of the lowest point in an already kind of low elevation area. So when it rains a lot, when there's a big hurricane that brings a lot of precipitation, all of the water flows to the lowest point, and that happens to be this site. What we're doing is we're doing a sort of cut and fill and reforming the site a little bit to make it, and daylighting the historic creek that used to be there. So the capacity of the site is up to 20 times the capacity that it is at now. So mitigating flood events, rain, basically flooding of the adjacent 15 to 20 parcels during rain events. And we're also developing a master plan in conjunction with this pilot site. And this is in collaboration with Forerunner, a mitigation startup based in New York City that we're working with. And this also plays on the FEMA flood insurance program, specifically the community rating system. So it's a little complicated, but essentially, if the city were to put forward, say, a dozen of these parcels, a dozen similar stormwater parks, or even 80 of these similar stormwater parks, the whole city, the whole municipality of North Miami could see flood insurance discounts of up to 15% additional than they receive now.
So, I mean, this is just me being the layman. So basically, you're finding those lowest points and saying we could turn those lowest points into just get all the water to go into these places. And that could help.
Yeah, and this, I think the name Good Neighbor kind of helps simplify this to some extent. So the federal term for these properties that flood frequently are called repetitive loss. And we, Department of Design Office and our entire design team, we're a bit critical of this term. And thus we refer to it as good neighbor, as like what is sort of the positive opportunities and that come from this site that is that receiving lots of water and already at a low point.
Yeah. You're from Florida originally, and you studied here in Miami. I wonder, like, the time that you spent here, how that kind of, you know, changed your views and helped you understand, you know, sea level rise and the issues that this area is going to face over the next century.
Yeah, so I'm from the Florida Panhandle in Choctahatchee Bay, so a small rural community that's now sort of developing similar to South Florida. And I went to University of Miami for 5 years for architecture school, so driving back and forth from, you know, Florida Panhandle down to Miami, you really see the whole transect of Florida and the ways in which they handle stormwater management across the entire state. And when I was living in Miami, it was around 2009 to 2014. It was when King Tide was first sort of being labeled and observed and more becoming present in the everyday eye of the residents of the community. And I think just observing the actual ground is something that's somewhat in my nature due to the fact that I grew up in a family of site contractors. We did beach nourishment, we did dredging, we put stormwater retention ponds for a living, and then going to a design school and trying to think about how can we educate the community, especially communities in Florida where living with the water or living above the water or near the water is a part of everyday life, even if it's not cognizant on the front of your mind.
I'm talking with Isaac Stein, co-founder of Landscape Architecture and Urban Design Studio called Department of Design Office. Now, that studio was recently awarded $80,000 to transform a flood-prone plot of land in North Miami. And this could be a big way in the future for us to deal with the issue of sea level rise and flooding and how to protect communities. Isaac, what was the objective of the Keeping Current competition? What are they trying to achieve?
Keeping Current is a competition that's sort of run by Van Allen Institute, which is a New York City nonprofit that looks to develop design competitions around the United States to help cities, municipalities, and communities understand their environment and to create more resilient communities. Specifically in Miami, it's a threefold part. I can speak specifically to our aspect, which is repetitive loss competition in the city of North Miami. And what they're really hoping to do is to bring a focus to underserved communities that are often overlooked in resilience projects. Because quite often when you think of resilience or you think of climate change or sea level rise, the mind's eye goes to Miami Beach or Brickell. And this project is very special in a way that it's fully philanthropically funded and it allows us to go to communities that will be affected and basically aren't getting a lot of the press and the opportunities and design thinking to help approach these problems.
Is this a project that you think could be adapted in any neighborhood?
Yeah, I mean, we do view this project as a showcase for South Florida region and even coastal communities throughout the entire East Coast. Again, it depends on what the region's elevation is and the relationship to the water. But I think in similar environments where you receive a lot of local flooding and is at risk and adjacent to other properties that receive lots of local flooding, it allows a way to mitigate sort of the issues and allows the community to engage with the issue itself.
How long do you have to develop this plan?
So this is a very fast-paced project. We're going through permitting now. We've received one of our three permits to date, and we're actually slated to have a opening on December 15th of this year.
And again, just to, you know, to come back, this was, it's going to be turned into a park so people can enjoy it. But again, during flooding, this is basically, and again, from renderings, it's where we're going to collect water. And that, as you said, this could help lower or give discounts for flood insurance.
Yeah, this lot specifically, we're hoping is a showcase to sort of create some wherewithal and momentum to create more of these parcels and more of these stormwater parks. Because this parcel itself won't necessarily create flood insurance rates, but just a few of them will help decrease rates slightly. And then the more and more you incorporate into a municipality, the lower and lower your insurance rates will be.
Isaac Stein is co-founder of the Landscape Architecture and Urban Design Studio called Department of Design Office. They were recently awarded with the opportunity to transform a flood-prone plot of land in North Miami. And this, again, could be an idea for the future as we think about sea level rise and the issues of flooding. And you could, by the way, you could learn more about what that looks like in this project. There are renderings from the Miami Herald. We have some of that on our website, WLRN.org. Isaac, again, congratulations. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Still to come, a film about Cuba's first female doctor who had to disguise herself as a man. It's part of the Outshine Film Festival. It starts this week. More on that coming up next. High school can be a very difficult transition time, especially for those finding their identity. Junior Adam Freeman left his rural hometown to visit his young sister in New York City. He was launched into Brooklyn's LGBTQ scene more so than he could have ever imagined. Let's take a listen to the trailer from the film Adam.
Up with me. Everybody here is like way older than you and gay.
Those guys are your friends?
Yeah, they're my bros.
Cool. I don't want to mess this up. I've never dated a trans guy before.
I lied to her.
I told her I go to Berkeley, and if she asks, I'm going to say that I'm 20.
Dude, you look 12.
And the film Adam is opening night film for the Outshine Film Festival starting this Thursday in Fort Lauderdale. Victor Jimenez is the festival's director, and he's in studio with me now. Victor, great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
We live in this era where there are so many platforms and opportunities for people across the spectrum to have their voices heard. Whose stories do you want to bring into the spotlight for Outshine for this upcoming year?
We are the local LGBTQ film festival, so obviously we focus on stories of that. This festival for Fort Lauderdale, it's a lot about definitely underrepresented voices, even within the LGBT community, transgendered voices, voices of individuals coming from the other countries looking for asylum here in the United States. Not your typical, for lack of a better term, you know, white gay male stories. And there's been a strong focus recently in our film festival programming for films that enhance other points of view.
Who do you, I mean, for your audience, I'm wondering, like, do you tend to have more LGBTQ audience, or do you see, you know, more people from heterosexuals who just come to watch the films?
Our audience is predominantly LGBT, and there will always be a few films that we have that will have a few more mainstream straight audience members. It always just depends on the film, to be honest. And also if there's a local connection. But for the most part, I would say 90% of our audience is LGBT.
All right. So you have a very diverse lineup of films for this year. First, tell us about the film for the opening night. We just heard the trailer, Adam. It follows this awkward high schooler leaving his rural hometown, opening his eyes to the world in New York City. That could be an eye-opener for a lot of us. Tell us a little bit more about the movie.
You know, Adam's interesting. Usually it's a fish out of water story, but it's usually, let's say, you know, a gay person trying to fit in into a straight world. In this case, you have Adam, who's a straight high school kid going to see his sister, and he's trying to fit into this LGBT world. And from the clip you heard, you know, he gets mistaken for a trans male. And, you know, he's a young high school kid, you know, not making the smartest decision. He decides to go with it. And it's this really offbeat romantic comedy, for lack of a better description, of like this fish out of water story, but it's really told really well. The director himself is a trans male, so it's not a pandering film. It's actually a very well thoughtful film in how it presents the stories and how we're all basically human and how we're all just trying to get along and how sometimes we just do a stupid thing just trying to fit in and with the in crowd. And in this case, the in crowd is an LGBT crowd, and he's just a younger brother trying to fit in with his sister's friends.
Is it true the star of the film is from Daytona Beach?
Yes, Nicholas Alexander is from Daytona Beach, yes.
So I'm wondering how much of his story is meant to encapsulate that experience of, again, many young men who haven't fully come into their own sexuality and finding their place. I mean, I think that's what I'm gathering from what you're saying.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how much of Nicholas's personal story is in the actual Adam. Nicholas is an interesting guy. He's a very shy, introverted type of guy. You can actually definitely see how someone might confuse him in real life as actually a trans male, to be honest. He's a good actor. And I think he's a very current generation person. Not that I'm saying he's gender fluid, but I can definitely see him having that problem with being gender fluid and the whole description of that and him just going along with the flow. So I can see, I'm sure he fit real well into the role of Adam.
So another film that caught my eye, it's got a lot of controversy. It tells the true story of the first female doctor in Cuba. She disguised herself as a man in order to practice medicine. Tell us about, hope I'm saying this right, Enrique Faber?
Yes, correct. Okay. Yeah, Defiant Souls is the film. It's a centerpiece film. It's next Thursday. It's an incredible film. Just the look of the film is incredible. It's also a time of Cuba you don't really see a lot of history from, or films from, 19th century, turn of the century Cuba, and where there were slave owners, and the well-to-do did not treat other people real well. And then there's Enrique. She's coming into the island to find her son that was taken away from her when she was in Switzerland, discovers that there was a big fire in the plantation where he was living. And while he's working there in this small rural town, he becomes ingrained in the city, in the townspeople, again, with the aristocracy there. But then he also decides to also help out the slaves, and this creates friction. And then since all this friction is happening and all this tension, the people that used to be his friends all of a sudden turn on him and basically will eventually discover, her secret. And all the stuff that basically happens after the revelation.
It is fascinating. I mean, these are stories in history, where you've seen anywhere, different parts of the world, where a woman has to disguise herself as a man to be able to either fight in a war or do this or that, and watching the trailer for this film, really amazing how they help create that transformation.
Yeah, most definitely. And also how they introduce Enrique, he's just in the town, someone needs help. Since he's not a pure Spanish speaker, he's from Switzerland, no one got thrown off by his, bad Spanish accent, for lack of a better term. And again, just because he was fulfilling a need in the town, everybody enjoyed it. But then all of a sudden, when he causes friction, it's amazing how quickly the audience turns.
The film is in Spanish with English
yes,
subtitles.
Correct. Yes, correct.
Was it the director's intention to just showcase it for Latino audiences?
No, I think the film itself is made for any audience, but being true to the locale, which is Cuba, and Spanish-speaking, it's a Spanish, Spanish-language film.
I'm talking with Victor Jimenez, the executive director of the Outshine Film Festival. It kicks off in Fort Lauderdale this Thursday. You can find ticket information and details about all the different films on our website at WLRN.org. I wanted to make sure we had time to talk about some other films, this one in particular, which have connections here in South Florida. Let's listen to some of the trailer for Little Miss Westie. The documentary follows two trans siblings as they prepare for a pageant in West Haven, Connecticut.
We have two children, a boy and a girl. And it was a girl and a boy.
I'm not a pageant person. I kind of thought I was done when Luca was done. And so then when Ren wanted to do it, it was a little bit like, okay.
It was really fun for me. Except when I lost, because then I started crying on stage.
First of all, tell me, how did you find the story?
Little Miss Westie, it's actually, it should be like also just a narrative movie. It's just such a cute movie and the whole premise of it. We found the film through our regular screening process. We take submissions to the film festival. We have a screening committee. They make the decision, they make their call on the votes of all the submissions. It goes to a programming committee to determine what the final look of the festival is going to be. And that's how we discovered Little Miss Westie. And it's really a really cute documentary and something you don't see. And I was like, oh, I really wish this would be just like a narrative feature also. I could see it just being a crowd pleaser and just like this quirky comedy.
The director of the film, Dan Hunt, now lives in Wilton Manors. Right?
Yeah, Dan Hunt, he's a co-director. He lives in Wilton Manors. And then during the academic year, he teaches in New York in a New York Film Academy. He's basically by city, I guess.
When you think about it, the pageant story has been told in a lot of different ways. This is a very different perspective.
Yeah, it's different because you have the younger sister now who was a brother wants to do pageant, but then his older brother who was his sister did it already. And it's also like he, the older sibling, is the one that's gung-ho about, like, you know, this is how you win this tournament, and you got to do this. And then the younger sister is more like, oh, I just want to enjoy it.
I got to ask you about this one. I cannot let you go without asking you about. This is a film that was screened earlier this month. It's available on Amazon. Takes place in Wilton Manors. It's a documentary about the world of male strippers. Briefly tell me about All Male, All Nudes, Johnson's.
Yeah, it's basically set in... it follows Johnson's there on Wilton Drive, and it's basically the story of the actual nightclub, the founder of it, how, you know, he treats the dancers. They're not actually strippers or go-go dancers. They're not all nude, but it's an interesting story because it kind of humanizes people that normally you kind of have an impression. So like one of the dancers, you know, he's a dancer there, but he's also he does children's parties where he's dressed up like superhero, like a Spider-Man or whatever, and he's like the performance. And you know, and it kind of showcases the lives of the dancers when they're not actually at the club, and you know, they're like everybody else with their stories and whatever it was, however they got to that story, and also how the owner of Johnson's basically helps take care of them and make sure that they're kind of basically not messing up their lives.
What do you want people to take away from this year's festival?
It's all about our stories and being represented and learning more about ourselves and just different cultures. You know, like I am a Hispanic gay male, but there's plenty of other stories there that I'm not familiar with. You know, like the Little Miss Westy story or the Defiant Soul stories, you know, like women's stories, transgender stories that I didn't grow up with that experience. And those stories are there to be heard and seen.
How many films did you have to screen or go through to decide on this year's festival? Because I wonder how many you had to say no to you regret.
Well, we say no to a lot. You know, this festival has 31 feature-length films, a total of 50-length films. 50 films altogether, including shorts. We probably receive about 380 submissions, so we say no to a lot of films. And some of them, you know, some of them are painful. Like, you know, there's only so many docs we can show, and that's always the toughest call, because all those stories are generally good and they all should be told, but I have to be realistic to the audience that I have here and what they want to physically go see, too.
What do you think the audience in South Florida wants most? What have you learned about them?
Yeah, it depends. You know, we do a Miami festival in April. That's more foreign language films. Fort Lauderdale tends to have more English language films. It's a nice mixture. I think the audience here likes to be challenged and likes to discover new areas. Again, outside of the norm that you typically see. They want to discover that history of Cuba that, you know, people don't really talk about down here in South Florida. And they want to discover the experience of, you know, somebody else in another country, you know, like our closing night film about the former, you know, the Republic of Georgia, former Soviet Republic of Georgia, about what the experience is of being a gay male over there. And I think that's one of the main things my audience likes, is that they like learning about something they didn't know about before.
And I think something that you said before, too, I mean, considering we're in South Florida, mm-hmm. is that, you know, do we get enough stories of the Hispanic LGBTQ story?
Yes. It's you know, they're there, and we actually do a pretty good job of finding them, and from all different countries, Argentina, Chile, all the rest, you know, we do a good job of bringing them in.
So it starts Thursday. Remind people it starts Thursday. Runs 10.
Yeah, it starts Thursday, October 10th, and it goes through Sunday, October 20th, and then we have a different we have a film for you.
Victor Jimenez, Executive Director of the Outshine Film Festival. Again, as he said, starts Thursday. And if you want to find ticket information, more details, you can go to our website, WLRN.org. Victor, thanks so much. Have a great festival.
Thank you very much.
And that's our program for this Monday, October 7th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to hear from Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez about the future of the Miami-Dade Expressway Authority. Mayor Jimenez will also discuss his future political ambitions as he's leaving office after next year. Plus, saving money is difficult for any family, but the complications are even more difficult for families that have a child that's disabled. There's a special program in the state of Florida to teach families about saving for the disabled. We'll learn more about that. And finally, the Norton Museum of Art has a new artist-in-residency program beginning next year. We're going to learn about how the artists were selected and the work that they're going to be doing next year in West Palm Beach. All of that tomorrow on the program. Remember, you can find us online. Go to WLRN.org or on social media, Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd always love to hear from you, your thoughts on the program, and what are some of the issues that we should be discussing more of. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.